Dramatic developments at the Alan Schoenborn hearing, the shocking outbursts from BC's notorious child killer, and what he's asking for.
Also, video of a controversial VPD arrest. Contradictory statements about what led up to a young woman getting punched while being handcuffed.
And home sweet Stanley Park.
I've been living here for 34 years now.
The surprising life of Christensen Bailey in Vancouver's crown jewel.
You're watching Global BC. This is Global News Hour at 6.
Good evening. Thanks for joining us. Some explosive moments today at a review board hearing for Alan Schoenborn.
He's the man found not criminally responsible for killing his three children in Merritt. Our Romina Dea is live with more on what happened at that hearing today, including the revelation that he has a new name. Romina.
Yes, Sophie, Alan Schoenborn has legally changed his name, but his lawyer has applied for a publication ban. Now, we were permitted in the hearing today, and I have to say it was unprecedented. I haven't seen anything like it in my 20-plus years of journalism.
Alan Schoenborn has a new identity, a new name he wants to keep secret from the public. He's fearful he will be recognized.
I do think the public has the right to know his new name. I think they have a right to know who's moving into their neighborhood, to who to be concerned about, who their children should be concerned about, who the young ladies should be concerned about.
It's been 2 years since Schoenborn's last review board hearing. He looks like a different man compared to 16 years ago when he stabbed and smothered his three children, Caitlin, 10 years old, Max, 8, and Corden, 5, inside their trailer in Merritt. In 2010, he was found not criminally responsible due to mental disorder.
I think it's an absolute travesty that someone who's responsible for such a heinous crime could be able to legally change his name and to try and disassociate himself or cover up his actions.
Schoenborn has spent the last 14 years at the Forensic Psychiatric Hospital in Coquitlam. A representative for the director of the hospital told the review board Wednesday Schoenborn still poses a risk to public safety, therefore he should not be released. Crown and defense agree. Schoenborn should stay in hospital for the next 12 months. A doctor said Schoenborn has ongoing anger management issues. There have been 15 incidents over the last 2 years. He's been aggressive to staff. Schoenborn's lawyer says his psychotic illness is under control. His urine tests are clean. There have been very few negative interactions in 14 years. And Schoenborn has been on good behavior while on unescorted day passes over the past 2 years.
Mr. Schoenborn is medically problematic, and he needs to be treated in a way that we can get him on the route to, at some point, perhaps reintegrating into society.
When questions arose about potential risk factors for violence, for example, what about jealousy in a relationship? Schoenborn reacted, "What the F is this?" When the doctor said there's a risk to children, Schoenborn erupted. BS, he said. This is nuts. No booze, no drugs, no children. Is this what it's going to say on my order? He said before leaving the room.
I believe that every day and in all my heart that he is going to be a hindrance to everybody and anybody, any community he moves into. He's going to be a problem.
Romina, pretty dramatic day. And there was another big development involving Schoenborn's lawyer.
Yes, Sophie, he quit. Rishi Gill was saying that Schoenborn was being treated unfairly by the board. He said that the board was inappropriate towards him. He said that they were shooting, quote, daggers at him, staring daggers at him. So in that point, the board denied the allegations, but Schoenborn was left without any counsel. So they really had no choice but to adjourn the matter over to another date. So the family was here, friends were here of the victims. Everybody has been waiting for this for 2 years now. So again, the date has been adjourned and we're hoping to get some sort of update in about a week. Back to you.
All right, thanks for that. Romina Dea reporting live in Coquitlam.
Vancouver police are explaining their actions after a complaint from a young Indigenous woman punched during an arrest. Much of the altercation was caught on video, but it doesn't show the whole story. Angela Jung shows us why in this global exclusive.
This New Year's Eve arrest now raising questions about use of force.
My hands were behind my back, and then, like, they were kneeling on me. Like, out of nowhere, he, like, just punched me.
We've agreed to protect the identity of this young Indigenous woman. She says she feels confused and upset because she was the one who called 911 to get someone intoxicated and aggressive out of the building. But somehow, she became a suspect.
I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to kick him. It just, like, when he grabbed my wrist, it, like, I reacted.
Seconds later, the officer strikes her.
In the back of my head.
VPD defends the officer's actions, saying the woman was injuring him.
She's continuing to resist arrest. The officer delivered one punch that caused her to release the grip that she had on his finger. That was completely justified given the circumstances. It's a lawful and justified use of force given the circumstances.
I don't know how I would be able to pull his finger if they're putting me in cuffs and holding my wrist. Like, how would my hand get to pulling his finger?
We showed the footage to former Solicitor General Cash Heed, who spent the majority of his policing career with the VPD.
It looks like excessive force. It may have been a retaliatory strike based on what happened previously. The situation was under complete control once this individual was taken to the ground.
The CEO of an Indigenous nonprofit called Access says it takes a lot of courage for Indigenous people to call police for help.
How can our people trust the police? How can we call for help if this is going to happen to us when we do call?
Look what this guy is doing. He's holding the building so we can't get up.
The woman wasn't charged. The Office of the Police Complaint Commissioner is now looking into the allegation of misconduct.
Just because they have a badge doesn't mean they can do what they do.
And questions of the force used. Angela Jung, Global News.
Well, there was no new funding for Metro Vancouver Transit in Tuesday's federal budget, but today the provincial government stepped up with another cash infusion. TransLink and Metro Vancouver mayors say it is desperately needed to help the system keep up with record population growth. Aaron MacArthur reports.
New buses, expanded service, shorter wait times. The provincial government announcing a $300 million capital investment in transit around Metro Vancouver. The money coming one day after the federal government left transit out of the 2024 budget.
Where's the transit in the transit-oriented development is my question for Ottawa on a day like today. We would love to have them join us here in North Vancouver to talk about moving forward and expanding service, which we are doing.
The Liberal government instead pointing to the commitment of a permanent fund of $3 billion to be made available in 2026. But according to Metro Vancouver mayors, that timeline not soon enough, given record population growth around the region.
We can't wait until 2026 and 2027 to have that online. We're feeling the impacts now. We need the investment now.
While ridership has nearly rebounded fully to pre-pandemic levels, falling gas tax and fare revenue will leave TransLink with a significant budget shortfall. The gap projected to be more than $4.5 billion by 2033. TransLink CEO Kevin Quinn says without new sources of funding, current service levels can't be guaranteed past 2025.
Following that, we do need to have a serious conversation, and I'm encouraged by the talks that we're having with the provincial government, with the mayors, around funding sources.
Despite the injection of cash from the provincial government, TransLink still hiking fares this year, the expanded service set to begin in the fall. Aaron MacArthur, Global News.
The federal government is committing billions of dollars in its budget to ramp up construction and try to solve the housing crisis.
But as Richard Zussman reports, those in the industry say the ongoing shortage of skilled workers is so profound, it makes the government's goals meaningless.
With each blow of the hammer, with every pipe in the ground, the federal government gets a bit closer to reaching its housing targets. But what if there's no one left to do the work?
The targets that the governments at every level are setting for us are almost unattainable without having all these tools that we can use.
The federal government unveiling a budget Tuesday built on building homes. But right now, 20% of construction and trade workers are 55 or over, expected to retire in the next few years, adding to a workforce that dropped by 7% in the past 5 years, meaning the industry is expected to be 6,600 workers short by 2033.
The challenge is we don't have enough people coming in to replace them.
Canada, and in particular BC, has seen massive population growth. But of the 460,000 new immigrants to Canada in the last year, just 9,000 worked in the trades, a measly 2%. A call on Ottawa to target these workers when welcoming people to Canada.
That is the fundamental purpose of the federal government controlling immigration. And unfortunately, they haven't been doing a very good job.
It does take time to build a home, and the challenge is significant. But I think it's also important to recognize we have a lot of things in our favor, right? Homes are being built already.
Federal NDP leader Jagmeet Singh says the federal government should be ensuring immigrants with skill training are arriving here.
Some union halls are saying we can actually have those workers come through the union and we can ensure they have the work in the trades. We can ensure that their work is being compensated appropriately and that it's keeping the level of employment and the level of salaries and wages up for everybody. So that might be something we look at as a solution.
And even more options will be needed if there's any hope to get to the goal of building 3.87 million homes by 2031. Richard Zussman, Global News, Victoria.
And for more context, let's bring in Keith Baldry. Keith, when you look at some of the projects underway in this province, it's pretty clear just how many skilled laborers are needed.
Exactly. So the building and housing sector is going to be competing with the mega project sector. We've got a number of projects in BC, been under construction for years, where we're employing thousands of skilled workers, so we're not going to start building houses. Here's a breakdown of some of the major projects we're currently seeing around BC. Topped by LNG Canada, has the most workers through the life of the project at 6,500. Site C Dam, last Friday, they had 2,720 people on the work site. Broadway Subway, through the life of the project, 950 workers. Patel Bridge, 300 for a total of almost 10,500. And this does not include the looming project to replace the Massey Tunnel and also the Surrey to Langley SkyTrain extension. That will likely require another couple thousand skilled workers. Again, people who might normally build housing are now put to work on mega projects, which illustrates the magnitude of the problem.
Good time to get in the trades. Keith, we'll switch gears a little bit. An interesting political move today.
Yes, Mike De Jong, no stranger, I think, to a lot of people who cover BC politics or follow BC politics, longtime cabinet minister under the BC Liberals, announcing today he's going to hope to seek the nomination for the federal Conservatives in the riding of Abbotsford, South Langley, a very stronghold for the Conservatives held by Ed Fast for a number of years. That's a scene for his big glasses back in 1994 when he won a pivotal by-election. No surprise here. Again, it's not going to be a cakewalk, though. It's going to be a contest. Nomination. Not sure what the date is, but he's going to have a lot of his former caucus members in the BC Liberal caucus working for him trying to secure that nomination.
All right. Thanks for that, Keith.
All right.
A new plan is in motion to try to rescue an orca calf in a Vancouver Island lagoon. As Cassidy Moscone reports, officials are drawing on the wisdom of the local First Nation to make sure they get the rescue right.
Two-year-old orca calf Quisa Hayes is stranded in the heart of Ahadasat territory.
Well, I think it's been close to my heart throughout the whole process. You know, it's kind of where we come from as Kowas people.
For Chief Simon John, saving her life has been at the forefront of every conversation for more than 3 weeks now.
It's a very emotional moment, and just to be considerate at the time what you're connection to the processes and how you actually can be more bearing on the circumstances.
His nation's people bringing years of invaluable expertise and local knowledge that's been passed down through the generations.
I think these are really important conversations to have with the relationship of nature and how nature is valued and deliberated on to make things more meaningful. I think really that is the key essence of what we're doing here, but at the same time, the main element of it is to save the calf.
Wednesday marks day 25 of brave little hunter being trapped in the lagoon. She's making herself comfortable right in the centre. It's the deepest part at more than 120 feet.
We want to do this as quickly as possible, as safe as possible, both for the animal
and also for the people that are involved. So we're not rushing ourselves.
Meantime, the town of Zabalos, population of around 200, waits with bated breath.
Everybody's hoping that they capture it and get it reunited with another pod, or maybe the same pod. Yeah. They might get lucky and find it.
As a Zabalos resident of 50 years, Dave was one of the many locals who sprung into action to try and save Brave Little Hunter's mother before she was beached.
Yeah, there was about a dozen people out there trying to roll it onto its stomach so that it could breathe. We tried to corral him down the inlet and chase him out through the gap, but he wouldn't go.
So we really have an entire nation and town working together to achieve this one goal, Chris, saving Quisahayas. It's been incredibly impressive to see the countless hours that have gone into this rescue mission. The chief today told me we should expect to see the calf out of this lagoon by the weekend. He's calling for calm and a respect to their process. Everyone here is hoping for a positive outcome. Chris?
We all are. Thanks, Cassidy.
Well, proof that just about anyone can fall for a scam.
Right away, I'm like, oh my God, I am just an idiot.
How fraudsters fooled one of BC's best-known tech experts, plus the advice he gives out that he now wishes he had followed. Next on the NewsHour.
From the skyline to the sky train, the daredevil and his videos now under investigation by transit police. Coming up later.
Also tonight, investigators crack the case of Canada's largest ever gold heist. How thieves allegedly pulled it off, still to come.
Right now, though, Facebook Marketplace is a good place to find a deal, but it's also a platform where you can get scammed if you're not careful.
Online fraud is becoming so sophisticated, even those in the business of educating people about scams can get duped. With more on that, let's bring in Consumer Matters reporter Anne Drua. Anne?
Thanks, Sophie. You know online fraud is getting more difficult to detect when a tech expert gets scammed. That's exactly what happened to digital specialist Mike Agarbo. He says he recently fell for a Facebook Marketplace scam, and now he's warning others by sharing his story.
Many of us have been there searching for everyday items on Facebook Marketplace, hoping to score a bargain.
And I thought, hey, that is a great deal.
And digital expert Mike Agarbo is no exception. Recently, he says he came across this patio set on the e-commerce platform and says the price was right.
It seemed a little low, but I thought it wasn't kind of out of the realm as far as, you know, used patio sets.
Agarbo says he messaged the seller, who agreed to meet with him the following day. Agarbo says he was given an address, a phone number, but then he got a request from the seller.
They asked then, hey, you know, a lot of people are asking about this. Could we take a small deposit to hold the patio set? I'm like, yeah, that doesn't sound unreasonable. And I didn't think about it. I just kind of whipped off $50 in an e-transfer. And the second I did it, my brain's going, wait a minute.
Agarbo says he started doing his homework, beginning with the seller's Facebook profile and running the picture through a website which determined the photo was a fake, likely generated by artificial intelligence.
I uploaded the photo there, and this website basically then gives you the probability of whether it was generated by AI or a human actually took the photo. And the probability it gave me was 86% that it was generated by AI.
In addition, Agarbo says he was able to determine the seller had no Facebook history and the phone number originated outside of Canada. It was then, Agarbo says, he realized he had been duped.
I know this stuff. I do shows about online fraud and scams and how not to get scammed. But it was just so casual and conversational, the messaging going back and forth. I just fell for it.
Consumer Matters reached out to Meta, Facebook's parent company, asking why it doesn't put some type of verification process in place for online sellers on Marketplace to protect consumers. But we never received a response.
I think Facebook Meta has to do better when it comes to the Marketplace. It is truly a Wild West, and there are scams happening all the time.
Agarbo says your best defense is to have your eyes wide open.
Will you be going on Facebook Marketplace in the future?
I will, but I will be 10 times more cautious than I have been in the past.
Now, some other tips to protect yourself. If a deal sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Look at the Facebook profile. How long has the person been there? Do they have friends? And Agarbo suggests using the Google image search to see if the merchandise photo is a stock photo or if it's been used in other ads before. And don't do e-transfer deposits. If possible, meet in person, check out the items in a safe public place, and use cash. And if you have a consumer issue for me, you can email at consumermatters@globalnews.ca.
All right. Thanks for that, Anne.
A law-breaking daredevil is getting a lot of attention on social media, but police are warning his actions are dangerous and potentially deadly. Emily Lazatin shows us the latest stunt now under investigation.
Cue the music and the shot. You could mistake this for a movie stunt, but it's not. It's the real deal, and it's caught the eyes of commuters.
I saw it.
What do you think?
It's insane.
It's crazy. You think you're right, Pink.
It's called train surfing, and it has the potential to be deadly.
Not only safety risks for person who do it, it's safety risks for everybody right now in the train.
A statement from Metro Vancouver Transit Police reads in part, acts like these may give rise to social media viewers and followers. However, they are extremely dangerous and could result in lifelong injuries or death.
Riding, standing, or holding on to the exterior of a transit vehicle is an offense that can lead to a small fine or criminal charges. Metro Vancouver Transit Police are not saying much about this latest incident, but they are investigating.
In this case, it seems more like they're looking to get attention to their videos. And it's entirely possible that they have some idea of making money from sponsorship or advertising down the line.
It's not the first time train surfing has been an issue in Metro Vancouver. In 2021, this duo was spotted on top the Canada Line, not strapped, traveling from Lansdowne to Aberdeen Station. And this man, caught riding between train cars between Main and Broadway stations, fined just $115. In 2017, more of the same reckless behavior.
Yo, this is going straight to YouTube tonight, man.
And this video, now more than a decade old.
An influencer like this might be pushed to take greater and greater risks.
Hey, you guys are sick, man.
And similarly, people who are imitating them might be pushed to take greater and greater risks.
It might be a thrill to this individual, but if someone slips, it is game over. Emily Lazatin, Global News.
The man who likely knows Stanley Park better than anyone.
Do you think you have achieved what you came here to do?
Oh, beyond what I ever expected.
What he's seen in 34 years of living there and why authorities have let him be.
Opening up how Emerson the Elephant Seal is proving he's very smart and very stubborn. As a major tree cutting project continues in Stanley Park, it's revealing a secret, a man who's been living in the dense forest for decades.
Christensen Bailey set up camp 34 years ago, known only to a handful of people. But now, due to circumstances beyond his control, his time in the park is coming to an end. Alyssa Tebow joins us live in studio with more on his story. Alyssa, you first met Chris Bailey months ago.
Yeah, it was back in November. There had been stories about someone living for decades in Stanley Park, so we just started asking some questions. We were introduced to Chris, and after a number of meetings, we started talking about him sharing his story. Now, this is not about the housing crisis or the cost of living. This is a man who made a conscious decision to live relatively off-grid, making art in the middle of a city, and we found out why he's been allowed to stay.
Good morning.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Good. Meet Stanley Park's longest resident.
Thanks for having us. Hi. My name is Christensen Bailey. Chris is good. I've been living here for 34 years now.
Since 1990, Chris Bailey has lived in the forest in the middle of Vancouver.
When I first went in there, I was bagging geese and cooking them. The first 17 years in here were candlelight.
But at age 74, and with trees around his campsite being cut down, leaving him exposed, Chris's time in the park is coming to an end.
Do you think you have achieved what you came here to do?
Oh, beyond what I ever expected.
This is his story.
It's 2 degrees right now.
How much?
It's 2 degrees right
now. 2 degrees. No problem. These are a good jacket.
Everything about Chris's campsite is simple but functional.
The rain factor that comes down just like water off a duck's back.
Accounting for the rain and the cold.
Right, you got a blanket, one sleeping bag, two, three, and a fourth. So that's good for like 20 below.
The roof is made of clear tarpaulin and old fishing nets, so natural light beams through. Flowers add colour, and one side of the tent is always open, so birds can fly in.
The chickadees are a godsend, really. It's a whole relationship that, say, over 7 or 8 years has kind of been really total support.
Chris was born in the US, but his family moved to Canada when he was a teenager so his father could work in Ottawa.
He had a couple of degrees, was a lecturer at MIT.
He studied maths and engineering at university and was briefly married, but Chris found his true self in art.
And the way that I was perceiving life, the people that I was associating with, or viewing nightly, you know, I was not happy with. And when I saw the opportunity to go to another situation in the art world, you know, I jumped on it.
Chris visited Vancouver in 1981 on a hitchhiking trip from Toronto. That was his first experience camping in Stanley Park. The combination of the forest and the ocean in the middle of a city drew him back less than a decade later when Chris turned 40, and he never left.
The quest is for mind, you know, to look at influences of the peace and quiet of the forest on creativity, and that's square one 30 years ago.
Each morning he meditates for an hour before dawn, and art,
I've got several other bags like that,
is his true passion.
How long do you think you would spend doing this in a day?
In a day? Mm-hmm. The whole day.
Abstract paintings and sketches created in the forest.
Did you make this music?
Yeah.
He even makes his own music, playing flute and horn over jazz backing tracks.
How do you record it?
How do I record it? I have some very good recording gear and mix it on, you know, a phone.
Living outside, Chris is exposed to the elements. He bunkered down during Vancouver's 1996 storm of the century. The 2021 heat dome, he hardly noticed. But the windstorm is a scarring memory.
That's an experience which, you know, I wouldn't wish on anybody. This tree that came down between the maples, this tree that I'm standing on, this portion here, came down.
In 2006, hurricane force winds ripped through Vancouver. Chris took shelter under a log.
15 feet over, another tree came down, and then 10 feet beyond that is where I would be sheltering when the wind came in.
What did that sound like?
What does it sound like?
The wind.
Sounds like freight trains coming in.
Around him, more than 10,000 trees were uprooted.
To see that or witness that is, you know, like devastating. Really, you hardly ever get over it.
Despite his camp being fairly hidden, Chris's presence wasn't a secret.
Because if he didn't come by, we would go out and check on him.
Now retired Vancouver Police Constable Mike Keller first met Chris Bailey in 2003.
He seemed to be very, very well equipped for himself, like he was very self-sufficient.
Keller spent 20 years with the VPD's mounted unit in Stanley Park. It's their job to know who's in the forest.
We were really focused on the people that were drug addicted, alcohol addicted, involved in crime, maybe using the park as a place to hide or even do crime. Chris was not one of those people.
There have been a lot of people living in the park, and I think a lot of people will be surprised by that.
Sergeant Susan Sharp has known Chris since 2010. She says during her time with the VPD, there have been around 10 long-term residents in Stanley Park, all men over 50. Chris's stay is the longest.
My relationship with him was special and unique. He was very special and unique. He wasn't like other people that were living in the park. Every Christmas, I get a note from him via email or a text message just saying Merry Christmas.
At Christmas time one year, he brought me some art.
It's this connection to art and nature that's kept him here so long.
When you first went into the park, did you know at that point that you were going to be there for 30 years?
No, not at all. You know, if I checked out of here tomorrow into the great beyond, you know, why not go with it?
What a remarkable life he's led so far, Alyssa. What are we going to learn about Chris tomorrow?
So tomorrow we're going to explore more of how he has lived outside for this long, picking up odd jobs around the city, using computers at the UBC library. But a health challenge a few years ago changed everything. You're going to meet the caseworker who changed Chris's life and got him a pension. And you can read more details about this story online. The piece has just been published. You can also see some extended video there. Sophie?
Fascinating. All right. Thanks for that, Alyssa.
Sure is. All right, coming up, the homesick elephant seal.
I'm so pleased that Emerson has become a bit of a celebrity.
After being relocated to northern Vancouver Island, how Emerson shocked everyone showing up back on the same beach. Victoria attracts a lot of repeat visitors, but one in particular is now causing concern.
Yeah, as Kylie Stanton shows us, Emerson the elephant seal is back after being relocated to the other side of the island earlier this month.
This is a nice comfy spot.
Between the view and the sound of the waves rolling in, it's like a five-star resort.
It's awesome, yeah.
A natural pick for someone whose only plan is to lay on a beach for weeks on end.
Like sunbathing, having a really good time.
But the only way to live out that dream is to live vicariously through this guy.
Hi, Emerson.
That's right.
I love ya.
He's back.
We thought we'd come and check it out.
He must just love it here, right?
Emerson, the elephant seal, arrived back in Greater Victoria last week, once again giving the public a front row seat as he molts.
They really do like specific sites to carry out these life functions, and Emerson, for whatever reason, has chosen the beaches of Victoria.
The two-year-old animal first arrived in the Gorge Waterway April 1st, where he spent 5 days getting himself into some trouble, moving from the beach up onto the roadway. Soon enough, Fisheries and Oceans Canada had no choice but to intervene. On April 5th, Emerson was moved to Barkley Sound on the west coast of Vancouver Island, 150 kilometers away. But just 5 days later, he was spotted back in the Greater Victoria area, this time in McNeil Bay, a trek of roughly 30 kilometers a day.
Which is incredible. He's a real rascal. And, you know, we love him, but we hate him too, because he just keeps coming back.
Emerson was born just across the border in the U.S. and spent his early days in the care of volunteers, which may explain his love for people. The problem is, the feeling's mutual.
He's so beautiful.
The beach here is now closed and volunteers are on hand to ensure Emerson and the public's safety. If anyone is found to be in violation of marine mammal regulations,
the Department of Fisheries and Oceans can fine you up to $100,000.
On the off chance this spot doesn't work out, officials say they will try relocating him yet again. Try being the operative word.
He's determined that this beautiful beach is his home. But who can blame him? Look at this.
Kylie Stanton, Global News.
Well, just ahead, a breakthrough in a baffling mystery.
This story is a sensational one.
Several arrests and a suspected inside job stealing $20 million in gold from Toronto's Pearson Airport.
And assessing the damage from a brutal cold spell. Why Okanagan cherries could be a very rare treat this year. They warned us of the potential for disaster, and now Okanagan cherry growers say their worst fears are being confirmed.
Yeah, this is not good. Cherry trees would normally be full of blossoms right now, but instead, there are few blooms, if any. January's brutal cold snap, which came after mild temperatures, pretty much killed the chance of a significant harvest. But growers say that doesn't mean all of their costs are coming down.
Now that we've arrived at blossom time, it really shows the damage. It's a disaster. Like, this is the worst I've ever seen.
We still have to spend all the money, because I've heard people tell me, like, oh, you get a summer off, but that's not how it works. We still have to go through and spray and do everything. We just won't harvest.
The provincial government has announced $70 million to help fruit and grape growers replant damaged crops. But farmers say they also need emergency aid this year.
All right, let's bring in meteorologist Christy Gordon now for a look at our weather forecast. A beautiful day, Christy, and some interesting looking clouds.
Yeah, we've had two photos of this sent in. This one from Costin, which is just a stunning shot. Shirley, thanks for this. This is a lenticular cloud, or these are lenticular clouds, lens-shaped clouds, and they're actually stationary clouds. Very rare indeed, although we had one from the weekend as well, just sent to us today from Hope. Thank you so much to Kristen for that one. Again, these are sort of like UFOs, but very neat to see that indeed. Now, we've got more sunshine on the way, everyone. Clear skies overnight tonight, so cold. We'll see that northerly flow, so still the wind will be cold tomorrow. We have a chance of flurries in the southeastern corner of the province, but then that's about it. Otherwise, we'll see a bit of cloud cover, but for the most part, sunny skies. And areas in the interior will be slightly below seasonal for this time of year. However, coastal regions will be near seasonal. So a daytime high of 16 degrees in Kelowna is typical, and they'll only see 13. But for Metro Vancouver, 15 to 18 degrees, and we're expecting 16 to 19 degrees on Friday. Still looking at rainfall later in the day, Saturday into Sunday morning, but it's certainly not a washout for the weekend. Tonight, Central Windows weather window coming to you from Tofino. And yes, we're getting more and more video for our weather windows. So thank you so much. Wayne Barnes sharing this. This was at sunset last night where we had these isolated thunderstorms. Sophie, I know you saw one from outside your window, which was really cool at sunset too. Thanks, Wayne, for that great one.
Is that what I saw? It was pretty. Beautiful clouds outside my window.
All right, Squires here with a look ahead to sports.
Well, the feeling is, it's not official, the feeling is the Canucks would start the playoffs Sunday at home. So will they rest anyone tomorrow against Winnipeg?
If we play Sunday, day off, we got some guys who got some aches and pains, and is it better for them not to play? Like, these are the things we got to go through.
Of course, the Winnipeg game tomorrow could mean something to the Canucks' final standings as well.
Also tonight,
6,600 gold bars weighing over 400 kilograms.
The largest gold heist in Canadian history and what investigators say they did with the loot. Are you all ready?
Are you all ready? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Tickle?
Okay, a little bit, but it's gone now. I did enough of hems to get it out of there. We don't know when the Canucks will start the playoffs. Maybe Sunday. We don't know who they'll play in round one. Right now it's Nashville. We don't know if they'll be the number one or number two seed in the Western Conference. A lot of that depends on tonight's game between Dallas and St. Louis, which is just getting underway. If the Stars lose that game in regulation, then Vancouver could get the number one seed in the West by defeating Winnipeg tomorrow night. If Dallas gets a point out of this game, then Vancouver will be the number two seed and their first-round opponent will be the Predators. That game tomorrow will have Thatcher Demko starting, but as for who will be playing in front of him, that's currently also unknown.
I'm not quite sure. It's a hour-to-hour thing. We don't know how we're going to approach the game tomorrow. But, you know, I think some guys might play, some guys might not. I honestly haven't at this point made a decision. You know, you talk to Hughes, he feels great today, you know, but that doesn't mean he plays. I don't know if he's going to play tomorrow. Like, these are the guys I have to kind of, we'll figure out. It's more of, you know, looking at if we play Sunday, the day off, we got some guys who got some aches and pains, and is it better for them not to play? Like, these are the things we got to go through.
Now, the Canucks, of course, won the Pacific Division last night with that victory over Calgary. Now, outside of the 2020 bubble playoffs, when they let 24 teams into the tournament instead of the regular 16, and all those games, of course, were played in front of nobody, this will be the first time for the Canucks, these Canucks, to play at home in a playoff game at Rogers Arena. And for players who've been here a while, like, say, Brock Besser, who've had to wander through the desert, that was what the Canucks were going through for years and years and years. Finally winning a division title and knowing they're playoff bound is incredible.
I'm not quite sure. It's a hour-to-hour thing. We don't know how we're going to approach the game tomorrow. But, you know, I think some guys might play, some guys might not. I honestly haven't at this point made a decision. You know, you talk to Hughes.
Okay, so that wasn't Brock Besser.
No.
But I will say that when we did talk to him, he was really excited about being in the playoffs and winning the division.
Fresh for late.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, let's go to the Blue Jays, shall we? They were taking on the Yankees today. And things started well for Toronto. Dalton Varsho here with the two-run homer. In fact, Toronto was up 4-1 at one point in this game with the Yankees. As you can tell by the way I'm talking, the Blue Jays blew the lead. They were the Blue Jays today, spelled B-L-E-W. Yep. Giancarlo Stanton with the homer there, final 6-4 for New York. Champions League. Why don't we check out a little of this? Manchester City against Real Madrid. Kevin De Bruyne. Yes, De Bruyne. Ties at 1-1. This would go to penalty kicks to decide who's going to the semis, and it was Real Madrid winning 4-3 in penalty kicks. Antonio Rudiger getting the winner right there. Bayern Munich against Arsenal. The winning goal in aggregate, this one. Beautiful header. Joshua Kimmich, 3-2 in aggregate. So, this is how they match up now in the semifinals in Champions League. Oh, and tonight in Kelowna, Rockets and Cougars. Prince George now has a 3-0 lead in that best of seven, so they can wrap it up tonight if they win.
All right, thanks, Squire.
Coming up, Operation 24 Karat, the investigation of a heist that seems torn from the pages of a Hollywood thriller and how the good guys won.
Jordan Armstrong is in the newsroom now with a look ahead to global news at 11 tonight. Jordan.
Sophie, Tim Hortons is in hot water again over a major malfunction with its Roll Up the Rim contest. At 11, how customers, including a BC woman, thought they had won a $60,000 boat, and how the coffee chain is responding. A full hour of late local news beginning at 11. Sophie?
All right. Thanks, Jordan.
Okay, so it was exactly 1 year ago that $20 million in gold was stolen from Pearson International Airport, making it the largest gold heist in Canadian history.
Well, now police have announced charges against several people, saying it was an inside job.
It was an extraordinary and brazen gold heist worthy of a Hollywood script. Exactly 1 year ago, a driver in a van pulled up to Air Canada Cargo, gave a waybill to an employee. A shipment was loaded into the van, which drove away. When Brinks Canada came for the shipment hours later, it was gone. Turns out the waybill was a fake, but the shipment was pure gold.
It had a value of over $20 million, and this particular theft has become the largest gold theft in Canadian history.
Gold and some $2 million in U.S. currency vanished. Police say it was an inside job with outside help, starting with that waybill.
This duplicate airway bill was printed off from a printer within Air Canada Cargo.
Police tracked the van, eventually found it. Revealing few other details, the investigation led to 5 men from the Toronto area being arrested, and a 6th, police say, was the driver arrested in the U.S. Canada-wide warrants have been issued for 3 others. One Air Canada employee and a former employee face charges of theft and conspiracy to commit an indictable offense.
In my opinion, yeah, they needed people inside Air Canada to facilitate this theft.
It's the kind of criminal enterprise that expands on the original theft, starting with the knowledge that a shipment of gold was being flown by Brinks from 2 Swiss banks in Zurich via Air Canada to Toronto. From there, a criminal assembly line of transporting the gold, then diversifying it into multiple ill-gotten gains, into gold jewelry, into money, and significantly, say police, into weapons.
This isn't just about gold. This is about how gold becomes guns.
Police seized melting casts to process the gold, recovered 6 crude gold bracelets worth $90,000, and seized $430,000, likely profits from selling the gold. And the van driver, say U.S. authorities, was stopped in a rental car in Pennsylvania. He tried to run away, say police, when they discovered dozens of firearms believed destined for Canada.
I'm proud to say that we successfully put this international gun trafficking operation out of business.
But these criminals thought they were more sophisticated than police. They were wrong.
Every day, organized crime gets away with lucrative operations across international borders. This was more like a Hollywood ending, a win for the good guys. Eric Sorensen, Global News, Toronto.
Expect to see George Clooney and Brad Pitt strolling.
Are we up to Ocean's 15 or Ocean's 20 now? I'm not sure.
All right. Christy, final word on the weather.
couple great days on the way today, that's for sure. This over the next couple of days, we're expecting 18 degrees away from the water on Thursday, 19 on Friday. Still a little bit of rainfall over the weekend, but pretty good forecast, that's for sure.
No doubt. We love it. All right. Thanks very much, Christy. Thanks for watching, everyone. Have a great night.
Good night, all.